This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. A new University of Iowa study called The Contacts of Sexual Involvement and Concurrent Sexual Partnerships takes a new look at what is now referred to as hookups or friends with benefits. The study by UI Professor Anthony Peck found that compared to those in serious relationships, people hooking up with a stranger are much more likely to spread potential discord and STDs. We'll talk to Peck. Later in the hour, we'll hear about a major first-class hotel about to open, but all places, a community college in Iowa. The hotel at Kirkwood Center. At Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids will be one of only seven teaching hotels in the U.S., training students in the Kirkwood Hospitality Arts Program, culinary arts, restaurant management, lodging management, and food service. The managers are promising you a great night's stay, a great restaurant, and all the amenities. Talk of Iowa, following news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Sociology Anthony Peck says grandma is almost certainly right. Jumping into bed isn't likely to lead to matrimony. Sex within the first week of a relationship is associated with a higher risk of non-monogamy. Peck's study, The Contacts of Sexual Involvement and Concurrent Sexual Partnerships, was published in a recent issue of Perspectives on Sexual and Reproductive Health. A generation ago, it might have been called sleeping around or one-night stands. The terminology has changed, but all of this doesn't necessarily mean hooking up leads to non-monogamy.
This study is looking at two issues. One is the ways in which people become sexually involved. And so, obviously, there are different relationship contexts for sexual involvement. Some people delay sexual involvement until they're in serious relationships or whether they might be engaged or married. And other people don't delay sexual involvement. They become sexually involved almost immediately, i.e. the hookup, maybe something like friends with benefits, or they might become involved when they're casually dating, which might be somewhere in between. So that's one side of the paper. And basically the objective was to look at whether or not these varying contexts of sexual involvement are linked to non-exclusive relationships after sexual involvement. Because non-exclusivity in these partnerships is associated with increasing the speed of the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases.
So is the main problem with hooking up and having more than one relationship at a time, and is it the health dangers that we're talking about here, or emotional damage at some point?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. One of the issues is sort of what are the kind of consequences of these new forms of sexual relationships? And so there are researchers who are sort of getting into looking at, like, for example, you know, are hookups and friends with benefits more associated with maybe negative psychological outcomes for individuals or for example, like relationship quality or relationship for the partnership. That wasn't the objective of my study. I was just looking at whether or not it was associated with non-exclusivity, which may lead to differences in emotional outcomes, but not necessarily because these, because friends with benefits and hookups, for example, typically don't have expectations of sexual exclusivity. So when there is an overlapping partner, or non-exclusive relationship, it doesn't necessarily have the same psychological damage as the more serious relationships.
How common are overlapping partners?
Well, in these data, this was looking at people living in the area of Chicago. So that's the city of Chicago as well as the suburbs. And about one third of the respondents reported that in their most recent partnership, they also had a secondary overlapping partnership at some point.
And this study is looking at adults and not adolescents, and because and that way the study is sort of unique because most hookup studies have been of adolescents only, right?
Yeah, the sort of the myth is that hookups started recently, right? And among the younger cohorts, the younger people, or among college students, when in actuality it might be more of a story that these behaviors are percolating down from the adults to the adolescents. So we didn't really, scholars weren't really paying attention to something like hookups and friends with benefits only as recently as 2000, I would say. But that didn't mean it didn't already exist. In fact, it probably did already exist. We just weren't paying attention to it as much. And so these behaviors were already present among adults and increasingly became more prevalent among adolescents. And that's when people start paying attention.
And why is it? Why did why are adolescents more interesting, I guess, for researchers? Is it just the fact that it's sort of shocking to have this behavior in adolescence, and it's more dangerous for adolescents?
Well, there's sort of a larger storyline about adolescent sexuality. So back in the old days, it used to be – back in the old days, I'm talking about like the 80s and 90s. People were concerned about out-of-wedlock as well as teenage fertility, you know, teenage mothers basically. And then they were also very concerned about whether or not adolescents were having sexual intercourse before they became adults. So this is sort of in that line of concern where people are thinking, well, you know, now we know that roughly half the adolescents will have sexual intercourse before they turn age 18. But if some of these relationships are occurring in non-romantic contexts, that kind of adds another sort of dimension to the ways in which adolescents become sexually active. Clearly, the non-romantic contexts don't have the romantic meanings that are so typically associated with maybe sexual debut in adolescence, or what people think that sexual debut might occur when it's with a boyfriend or a girlfriend. It's just more of a casual sex situation. So that, I think, is why people are obviously interested in non-romantic sexual relationships in adolescence.
When you say non-romantic sexual relationships, what does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that there aren't romantic expectations, or there isn't a romantic isn't a relationship that's got that trope of romance or dating for that matter. So it's a shift away from dating conventions, dating rituals, to essentially non-dating.
And when you say non-dating, so what you're saying is it's just all about sex and nothing else, and no looking forward to a possible permanent relationship.
Oftentimes that's true, but some of these relationships do actually end up developing into ongoing relationships, and so that's sort of the trick, which is yes, many of the hookups and friends with benefits are short-term relationships. But some of them do develop into ongoing relationships. Some of them may even turn into cohabitational relationships, or even marriages. And so understanding, does it matter for later family formation or later relationship outcomes is kind of a question. Because if it doesn't matter, then obviously, then why do people care? Why do people care to, you know, why do parents, for example, care about, you know, the way in which, a son or a daughter is, you know, starting to go out with some, you know, a significant other. And so that's sort of what this research is, at least all the research in this area is getting at, it, which is trying to understand whether or not the diversity in terms of the ways in which people become sexually involved matters at all.
Men are more than three times more likely to sleep around women in friends with benefits situations, or more likely to have multiple partners.
In both cases, for both men and women, I found that the non-romantic context, the friends with benefits, as well as the hookups, were associated with non-exclusivity.
Where did this phrase "friends with benefits" come from?
Good question.
I was thinking maybe it came from a sitcom or something, but
I'm going to say it really came from the adolescence. It was a term that maybe they had coined, and I think there was like a New York Times article, maybe back in 2003, that kind of, you know, really coined that phrase in terms of the public imagination.
Interesting fact, Professor Peck, from your study. Women who got along with their companions' parents were less likely than men to have multiple sex partners.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Well, in some senses, I think it's common sense, right? To the extent that the individuals in that relationship are invested in terms of the larger social network, it makes the cost of exclusivity or non-exclusivity higher.
But it seems funny that the parents have some impact on on anything.
It's more, I would see more along the lines of the investment that the people are making in these relationships, right? So they themselves start to see these relationships as important, and these relationships then act as a cost for them. Like, it makes it more expensive because they don't want to put these relationships at risk.
I suppose we're all wired differently when we're talking about friends with benefits. I suppose some people would never agree to a sexual relationship unless there was the possibility of something coming out of it that might be permanent. It's just because they were raised that way, maybe. Obviously, a lot of other people doesn't even cross their mind. So what is the benefit then? Is it just the sexual relationship? Is that enough of a benefit?
I think for some people it is. I mean, it may be that some people, you know, some people may be wired, as you put it, differently, in the sense that, you know, they're primarily only interested in long-term relationships. Why that it might be, maybe it is some sort of wiring issue with respect to biology, but at the same time, they might have been raised in a household that really promoted those sort of values and beliefs, mm-hmm. or they have friends that promote those values and beliefs. And on the flip side, it might be that there are other individuals who also are, you know, embedded in friends and family that don't promote those beliefs. So there's going to be some diversity. And I would say that there might even be diversity within one's own life course. There might be stages where individuals are primarily oriented towards short-term relationships. And that, to be frank, is during when people are younger. And as they get older, they get more oriented towards longer-term relationships. So there's a lot of diversity in terms of what people are looking for in relationships. And it might vary across individuals, might vary within an individual's life course.
Yeah. But how has it changed over the past generation?
Well, the big thing in terms of like the changing nature of sexual relationships, say, you know, during the 20th century, is the lifting of all the sort of social controls that were exerted on couples. So there's been a shift away from strong social controls on the ways in which people built their relationships to a much more sort of flexible model. So back in before World War II, for example, premarital sex was frowned upon by the vast majority of Americans. Today, premarital sex is not held by a significant proportion of the population of the United States population. And so what that says is basically, as those social controls are fading, people are being allowed to be a little more flexible at how they want to build their relationships. So they're getting to choose what they want to do. And because they're faced with these choices, they have to figure out ways of negotiating the formation of a relationship.
We'll continue our conversation with Professor Anthony Peck, Department of Sociology at the University of Iowa. He has an article in a recent issue of Perspectives on Sexual and Reproductive Health. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute. Iowa Public Radio. Back with Talk of Iowa, I'm Dennis Reese talking to Anthony Peck, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Iowa. Very interesting article in a recent issue of the Perspectives on Sexual and Reproductive Health about overlapping lovers, concurrent partners, friends with benefits, however you want to say it. And again, this Professor Peck, the study was about adults. So how do you define an adult? Is this... are college students part of this study?
These are non-institutionalized adults, so the college students would be if they were living not outside of a dormitory, but living in a house or an apartment.
So this was a very wide age range.
That's right, 18 to 60.
18 to 60. So how does it change, how does it change towards the upper end of that scale, people's relationships? Let's say the 50 to 60 age range.
Well, in terms of relationship context, I didn't specifically look at that association, but I think it would be safe to assume that individuals who are older are more likely to become sexually involved when they're more serious than the younger individuals.
So how much adultery is there really out there? Did you look at that at all?
This is looking at concurrent partnerships. So adultery would be like if there are expectations of sexual exclusivity. So I think roughly, and this is not my study, but roughly in among Americans, at least based on 1992 data, about a quarter of men reported having extramarital affair, and about one in six women did, 15% or so. On a year-to-year basis, I think extramarital sex is about 4% of married couples. So every year there's about, you know, 4 out of 100 couples, married couples, having exposure to an extramarital sex event. So,
and how many, you know, when we talk about you know, concurrent partners, how many partners are we talking about? It, what, two or three at sometimes at the same time, or that people have? And
not really part of the study. I'm just looking at whether or not they had, you know,
just whether they had them at all.
Yeah, yeah. To me, the interesting part of this question is, why would there be an association between the two? Which is, I mean, obviously I had reasons to suspect there was an association, but the question is there something about these relationships themselves that lead to increased non-exclusivity later on in the relationships? Or is it something about the people who are likely to form these relationships in the first place?
So what is the answer?
Well, it's sort of the $64,000 question,
which
is, and my study doesn't really address it, but I propose there are two possibilities. So on the one hand, one possibility is that these relationships themselves lead to changes in attitudes and beliefs that make them less exclusive. The other possibility is that the individuals who enter these relationships have these pre-existing beliefs in the first place. So that's an important story, because it becomes, figuring out which one it is tells us something about the nature of these relationships. If it is in fact that these relationships themselves cause non-exclusivity, well, that would be important from the standpoint of, you know, understanding the implications of hookups, for example. But if it turns out that it's the individuals selecting into these non-romantic relationships that are really at the root of the cause of the non-exclusivity, then it's not so much the relationships, it's the people who enter these relationships.
Has the media had something to do with this, do you think? Just the availability of, Facebook and the social networking sites that everybody knows who's out there and what they want, maybe?
Facebook, I don't know. That's a good question. I have no answer on that one. I'm sorry.
Yeah. What about metropolitan area, you know, large cities versus smaller towns?
Well, that certainly is probably part of the story, because this is a study of the Chicago region.
Yeah.
It's Cook County, so, you know, we're talking about 5 million plus people that it's representative of. And it's not like Iowa City, because in Iowa City we're primarily a college town, so we do have a population that's likely to engage in hookups, which is the college students. So there are going to be differences between, say, the metropolitan region, maybe other parts of the country, as well as Iowa, for example. There might be an urban-rural dimension to this that we don't really know much about.
So what are the perils of sexual round delays, as the New York Times reporter Pamela Paul asked you?
Well, it may be that and certainly these sexual round delays, or at least these concurrent partnerships, are known to be associated with the transmission, or at least the increased speed of transmission of sexually transmitted diseases.
Yeah.
And so that's the concern, is that these non-romantic relationships may be incubators for helping spread sexually transmitted diseases. And so there is a public health angle to this story that is of a concern. The reason why people pay a lot of attention to concurrency is that concurrency is a likely factor, for example, in the epidemic spread of AIDS and HIV in Africa. And so people pay a lot of attention to it.
Professor Peck, you have another study coming out, Hookups, Relationships, and Dating Quality?
Hookups, Dating, and Relationship Quality.
And Relationship Quality.
Yeah.
What? It sounds fascinating. What have you found out?
Well, so in that study, I'm actually trying to figure out whether or not the non-romantic relationships are associated with lower relationship quality. And so I did find an association between the two, which is probably not that surprising. The question, of course, is, as I said before, is what's behind that association? In ongoing relationships, why would the ones that started out originally as hookups and friends with benefits have lower relationship quality?
And what do you mean by lower relationship quality, though?
They're less satisfying emotionally and physically, less rewarding. They're less likely to be in love. So this is in ongoing relationships. So it, we're excluding the, all the hookups and friends with benefits that were one-time things. It's the ones that actually develop into longer-term relationships. I, what I did was I found a gap between the non-romantic and the more serious ones. The non-romantic ones had lower relationship quality in terms of emotional satisfaction, love, how rewarding the relationship was. And the question is, why would these non-romantic ones be less satisfying and rewarding? And what I found in the study was that the people who form the non-romantic relationships do in fact select into, are predisposed to having lower relationship quality. The association between non-romantic, relationships and relationship quality is explained by the propensity of individuals predisposed to lower relationship quality selecting into the non-romantic relationships. So it's not that the relationships themselves are cause lower relationship quality. It's that the people who enter these relationships just are more likely to find relationships less rewarding overall.
Oh, I see. So they're just maybe they just haven't had good luck with the relationships, or they've never experienced a really rewarding one, maybe, or something?
Or they're just not interested in
a, or they're just not,
they just don't, they're just not in the relationships to find, they're just not there to have a long-term relationship. They don't, for whatever reason, aren't interested in long-term benefits of relationships.
And how common is that?
Well, in that analysis, the non-romantic relationships accounted for about 1 in 6 partnerships of the ongoing relationships.
Yeah. And the myth is that women are looking for, you know, long-term relationships and romance, and men often aren't. They want the one-night stand. But I don't know that that's – is that still – is there still any truth in that those old characterizations between
men? Well, I mean, obviously in any population you're going to find both men, you know, men – with varying interests. Some will be interested in long-term relationships and others will be interested in short-term relationships. And likewise, there'll be women who are interested in long-term relationships and women who are interested in short-term relationships. The key question is, on average, is there a gender difference in terms of these things? And I think there was a study of college students recently by Kathleen Bogle that looked at hookups, and she did find a gender difference, which is not too surprising, which is the same old story that on average, men are more interested in short-term relationships than women.
And finally, on language, hookups, friends with benefits, and so forth. What was the language like a generation ago? Because these are new terms. What were affair? Was that the word we're using, or something else years ago?
Well, we're both dating ourselves, right?
Yeah.
yeah, these are new terms. I think when I was younger, and in college, for example, we didn't really have terms. Or in high school, other than casual sex or one night stands, I don't think we had these terms, and we would just refer to it that way. So there might, in some respects, you know, like today's terminology is somehow, perhaps more accurate, because casual sex and one night stands is a rather vast, category of behaviors.
Right. Well, thank you very, very much. Enjoyed reading this.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Anthony Peck is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. Coming up in the next half hour on Talk of Iowa, the nation's 7th teaching hotel is about to open in Cedar Rapids at Kirkwood Community College. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. Hotels and restaurants run by educational institutions for teaching purposes are relatively rare. Successful enterprises have been run for decades at places like Michigan State and Cornell University. At two-year colleges, only one has been in operation in Ohio. A community college in Iowa is about to open the 7th such hotel soon. The hotel at Kirkwood Center, a $30 million project set to go in July, with a state-of-the-art building, including a convention facility and restaurant, all for the purpose of training students in Kirkwood's hospitality arts programs. The tension is building as opening day approaches. I talked to three of the professional staff We'll also be training students, Melanie Ewalt, executive chef, Gene Rogers, director of sales, and general manager Lee Belfield.
Well, first and foremost, it's a teaching institution. So it is what is called in the educational world a teaching hotel. There are, as far as I can tell, perhaps seven of those in the United States and North America, for that matter. And a teaching hotel is defined as a hotel where students actually participate in the operating of the hotel itself. So we are the second that I can find, the second such hotel on a two-year campus in North America.
And where's the other one?
Hocking College in Nelsonville, Ohio.
Okay. So this is very unique, especially to a two-year program such as a community college, and actually just a few other teaching hotels at, what, four-year institutions?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
What would be the most well-known of those?
Cornell in New York has a teaching hotel. Michigan State has a teaching hotel. Houston has a teaching hotel. Oklahoma State.
So a teaching hotel is a full-fledged hotel that I could check into and have a nice room and a nice meal and swimming pool and just like any other hotel, maybe even better.
Right? Exactly. Well, the idea would be, at least as far as we're concerned, we have to teach best practices, which means we have to apply best practices. So it should be a great experience.
How many students will receive training there then at any given time?
Oh, there are about maybe not quite 300 students in the programs, the three programs total right now. So, gosh, at any one time, how many students would we have involved? I guess it could be as many as 30 or 40 at any one time.
And these are students that are in what's called the hospitality arts programs, which includes culinary arts, restaurant management, lodging management, and then food service and bakery.
Correct. That's right. The first three of those are our degreed programs, culinary arts, restaurant management, and lodging management. And then the other two programs are actually diplomas.
Do you have students who will be working there who are just working there for the hourly rate, maybe majoring in something else?
Yes. We expect to. We actually have a first job fair coming up on May 24th. I think in all likelihood we'll have Kirkwood students that are not part of the program applying for positions.
Lee, when did all of this start to be discussed for the first time at Kirkwood? When did somebody get the idea that Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa needs a first-class hotel?
Well, it's a great Kirkwood story, actually. I started teaching at Kirkwood in 2001 and taught restaurant management, background in food and beverage, also background in hotels. And my then boss, John Heenick, who was the dean of the business and IT department, asked me whether or not I'd be willing to help create a hotel management program because it didn't exist on the Kirkwood campus. And I said, sure, not really knowing what I was getting into. But John and I were working on that project. We were in a meeting in the foundation office at Kirkwood talking about what the program would look like and how we would train our students, et cetera. And I hesitated because I was afraid he would laugh at me. But this is the God's honest truth. I leaned over and whispered in John Heenick's ear, John, why don't we just build our own hotel? And I thought he'd laugh, but I've gotten to know John a little better, and I know Kirkwood better now. John turned and looked at me and said, that's an interesting idea. Here we are, what, 5 years later or whatever it is.
I'm sure, building a hotel costs a lot of money. How much did this cost?
The entire project is just under $30 million.
And it's a beautiful building.
Yes.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I've only seen the photographs in your on your website. It's a really classy-looking building, and a picture of the rooms. The rooms are absolutely beautiful. Gene Rogers is director of sales. Gene, welcome.
Thank you.
These rooms are, as I say, this is a beautiful facility. You must be really excited about this facility opening in just a matter of weeks.
Well, Dennis, it really is a dream sales job. When you have a product that is as beautiful and first class as not only our conference meeting facilities, but the guest room facilities, it really is a first class product to go out and tell the general public about. And I have been doing that since August 2009 when I joined the staff at the hotel at Kirkwood Center.
Did you conduct a marketing survey before this? The plans were made to see if, you know, does Cedar Rapids need another hotel in that part of town, for example? I mean, there's a lot of competition.
It is very interesting to call on not only the Cedar Rapids community, but the corridor and North Liberty and the Iowa City market I also call on. And there's a strong desire for another first-class, full-service hotel on our side of town because, you know, Kirkwood also is very active in the Corridor Business Alliance. We see that as just really the up-and-coming area, the hot spot, if you will, of this area. And so our hotel is perfectly placed, really, for either end of the corridor.
Well, you're not too far from the airport. Mm-hmm. And you're right off of 380. It's a pretty good location.
It's a wonderful location.
So you've been selling rooms, weddings, events for almost a year, and the hotel's not even open yet.
That's right. We have some group business on the books for, I believe, 2012 is our farthest out booking. We have about 26 weddings on the books on either a definite basis or a tentative basis. And just the corporate community having small meetings. You know, we're a 71-room hotel, but we do have 20,000 square feet of function space. So we have a large amount of function space, and it's state-of-the-art because when Kirkwood builds something, they really do it state-of-the-art. So our audiovisual capabilities in all of our ballroom space, our pre-function area is gorgeous. The artwork alone throughout the building, which is done by Kirkwood alums or Kirkwood students, is just gorgeous. So it's a very fun building to show off.
So real artwork, not the mass-produced hotel art sometimes.
No, you'll see real artwork. there is a sculpture in our pre-function space that is a water sculpture that was done by an artist who has sixth-generation Czech ties to the Cedar Rapids area, and she actually built the sculpture at her studio in Connecticut and had it shipped. So there's some outstanding art, and it just adds to the classiness of the space.
And just to clarify, this is the only hotel, no, it's not open quite yet, that's attached to an educational institution in Iowa. Lee, correct?
Well, it's the only teaching hotel.
Teaching hotel.
In Iowa. There is, Iowa State has a hotel on campus, and of course, University of Iowa has the Iowa.
Well, house. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so that's an important distinction. This is a teaching hotel. This is set up primarily to educate students in these various programs, which makes it unique. Melanie Ewalt is the executive chef of the hotel at Kirkwood Center. Melanie, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
You must be up to your neck in work right now. You're getting close to opening. So what sort of kitchen do you have? What sort of food will you be serving?
Oh, geez. State-of-the-art. State-of-the-art kitchen.
State-of-the-art food.
You can't ask for a better kitchen, really. Everything you've ever asked for I've ever asked for as a cook. It's really just some amazing equipment that we're going to have in there. And just being a part of this since day one, I was able to, with some other chef instructors, actually go through and really plan it out and figure out where we want everything and what equipment we wanted, what brand of equipment we wanted. The food itself, we're calling it New American. The banquet menus are really upscale, I think are a little bit different than what you're going to see, just to make it unique. The restaurant itself, of course, we have to serve the business travelers that will be coming in, so you have to have your basics for breakfast and lunch. We'll have sandwiches. We'll have some upscale items. We're calling it New American. My mother is actually Cuban, so I like the Latin flair, so you'll see that a little bit in there, mostly during dinner. Big fan of seafood, so you'll see some seafood in there. We're trying to do a few different things for dinner just to draw in some people in the corridor. Dry aging, we're talking about dry aging, some beef, a cowboy steak, so it would be a bone-in ribeye, meat and potatoes, your basics. But, you know, we want to attract as many people as we can, foodies, of course, but we also like like I said, need to serve the general public too and serve the travelers that we're going to have. So, and then I'll have students going in and out of the kitchen. They'll be working in the restaurant itself, cooking breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then they'll also be cooking for banquets.
So what's your background other than that? I mean, where did you come up with this interest in culinary arts as a career?
My grandmother, actually, yeah. Cooking with my grandmother in her kitchen in Miami and cooking Cuban food, and everything was really centered around food. And that's what got me started. And I actually went to Kirkwood myself, graduated from there, and then worked at various places in Iowa City.
Well, I hope you have a Cuban menu at some point, or somewhat of a Cuban.
Yeah, you'll see a couple things on there. That's what I have planned anyway.
Lee, let's talk prices. This is an educational institution. Does that mean that you'll be giving discounts to Iowa residents, or how competitive are the prices at the hotel?
Well, I think Jean hit the right note in her response to your earlier question. It'll be much like the guest room product, and by that I mean the prices will be comparable to what you would find at a first-class restaurant in the corridor. So food and beverage, guest rooms, meeting room, all the pricing will be comparable.
This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Today we're speaking with three people who are very involved with a hotel at Kirkwood Center. It'll be only one of two teaching hotels, restaurants connected to a two-year community college in the United States, only one of seven total nationwide, including all colleges set to open next in July of this summer. Lee Belfield is general manager, Melanie Ewalt, executive chef, Gene Rogers, director of sales. Lee, I was looking at the background of the construction of this hotel. It seems that on the surface, this hotel is totally green. And can it be any greener? You've got some very creative building management, geothermal heating and cooling, efficient lighting. Are you set to award, will it be a green certified facility?
Well, the LEED certification process, especially for hotels, is well, let's call it a process that's still evolving. So no, the college decided not to seek LEED certification. However, the college is very committed to all things green. And frankly, I don't know enough about the certification process to say whether or not we would technically qualify. But there are some really exciting, sustainable practices that have been included in the construction of the building.
According to one of the stories, it said you have seven pumps that'll be freezing ice and nine ice cube units late in the night when the energy rates are lowest. That trapped ice then melts the next day, cooling the hospitality arts classrooms, kitchens, and class act restaurant when daytime electric rates are much higher. I mean, this has to be just light years ahead of most other hotels, certainly.
Yes, I'm confident of that. It's light years ahead of most buildings. That particular system, I am told, is, I think, the second application or second installation in the state of Iowa.
Gene, there's an outdoor dining patio. Is that right?
Yes, I think this is one of the most exciting parts that when I give hard hat tours at this stage of the game or just tours in general of the space, not only will we have the Class Act restaurant, which folks in Cedar Rapids know as the student-run restaurant on the Kirkwood campus. Well, that actually is moving down to the new hotel space. But again, it needs to be a hotel that will be open for breakfast, lunch, dinner. So we want local folks who might not stay overnight in the hotel to also know that this is another great dining option with outdoor dining available. We'll have a beautiful patio with some soft seating and then nice dinner tables, heat lamps, seating for 54 people on this outdoor dining patio, which again will be open for breakfast, lunch, dinner, or stop after work and have a restoring beverage at the end of the day, sitting watching the sunset over Kirkwood Boulevard.
Let's talk about the students just for another couple of minutes, because the critical aspect of this whole facility is really to train students. But then you have a real job to do. You've got an actual hotel, a good size hotel to run, restaurants serving all meals 7 days a week. So how does the full-time staff, let's say the restaurant managers and the hotel managers, how do they coordinate their day-to-day work with training students, and how much of their schedule is training students?
I mean, it's constant. When we traveled around the country to look at other teaching hotels, Oklahoma State being one, Hocking College being another, made a couple other stops. One of the challenges that everybody talked about was how to integrate the students into the operation. Mm-hmm. And so what we've tried to do as a result of the visits is take their best advice, try to avoid some of the pitfalls, try to apply some of their best practices. In order to do so, the professional staff really has got to be intimately and constantly involved in the educational process. So there isn't any pulling it apart. There isn't any saying, okay, well, Chef Melanie, you're part of this operation. Today I want you to work on food cost, and tomorrow I want you to teach.
Mm-hmm.
We all have to do all of it all the time.
And Gene, you'll be working with students as director of sales, students who are in the, I assume, the lodging management portion?
Correct. I also have been an adjunct at Kirkwood since 2005. So I teach hospitality sales and marketing. I teach intro to lodging. But I think one of the things that I really had to really think about as I accepted the position and what we tell everyone who accepts a position at the hotel at Kirkwood Center is that mentorship is on everyone's job description. And it's much like we all have had interns in our business lives. And you know how sometimes it's taxing, if you will, to put into words what you are thinking so that the intern can gain your thought process and understand your thought process. Well, that's what we all have to do day in and day out. And frankly, I think it will challenge all of us patience-wise and energy-wise because you're doing more than just selling, and you're doing more than just teaching. You're combining both, but it's a rich experience, and it's a very rich story to tell.
What's the fun part for you, teaching or actually doing the day-to-day
stuff? Well, the hotel business is my passion. I'm a 20-year veteran in the hotel industry, so I would say that that's my first love. So then, of course, sharing something you're passionate about with students who have that same interest, influencing young minds, finding those gems that we can turn out in the hospitality industry that can go worldwide. Yeah. And I think that's our goal, to be known internationally as well as across the U.S.
What's the job market like out there for graduates of the hospitality arts? Are these students going to be able to find jobs pretty fast once they finish?
Yes, absolutely. You would have a hard time finding a restaurant within 50 miles of where we're sitting that didn't have a Kirkwood graduate or a Kirkwood student involved in it. So it really is, I think, mostly a matter of what the student wants to do. My information is anecdotal, but I don't know of a graduate of any one of our programs that wanted to continue to work in the industry. And sometimes they change their mind, by the way, but that wanted to work in the hospitality industry that can't get a job in the hospitality industry. Nationally and internationally, it's an enormously large employer. The industry is huge. You know, a well-run hotel that has a turnover rate of 50%, 50%, is really doing pretty well, which means that on an annual basis, you'll replace half of the employees working at the hotel. So there's always a demand.
Well, you three are so excited. I just, when you walked in the studio, I thought these three people are really excited about this project and the fact that it's opening so soon. You must really love the idea of this educational hotel. And I can tell you all think it's going to be a huge success. Melanie, what's the dinner menu going to look like on the first day? Have you planned it out yet?
Well, hopefully it's organized. That's my goal. The first day, well, you know, we're going to have specials, but I think we're going to open just running our basic menu. And like I said, we're going to have the steak and potatoes, but we're also going to have some nice seafood dishes, some upscale dishes, so we can really just have just about anybody come off the street and get something that they really, really will enjoy would want to come back.
Yeah. Will the menu be changing a lot from week to week?
Hopefully seasonally. And then, you know, possibly special every week.
And Gene, are you sold out on that first day?
Well, I keep moving up that construction opening date. I think the construction team are a little tired of hearing from me, but we've had to send some of our overnight interest to our friends, other hotels in the area. But yes, August is looking very, there's just a nice pattern. There's a nice flow of business in August, and then it just even improves in September and October and November. And we're getting lots of calls for holiday parties, of course, this December.
Lee, have these other educational hotels, you say, looks like a total of seven nationwide, have some of these have been operating for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. Have they been successful over the long term and just, you know, with making enough money to keep moving forward?
Well, yes, absolutely. The schools at Michigan State and at Cornell have been there for many years, and they're integral to their programs. The school at the University of Houston is actually the Hilton College at the University of Houston, and they fly the Hilton flag. The general manager told me that every year they have to get a waiver because they're not quite big enough. It's about 80 rooms, as I recall. But for some reason, the Hilton Corporation continues to approve their waiver. So I think that they're doing just fine. Certainly some of the most respected graduates come out of the programs that have teaching hotel. Hocking College, we visited there as well, and they seem to be very satisfied with their result.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with the hotel at Kirkwood Center. Thank you, Lee, Melanie, Jean. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Melanie Ewald, Jean Rogers, and General Manager Lee Belfield, the managers at the hotel at Kirkwood Center in Cedar Rapids. The $30 million facility is set to open in July for training students in Kirkwood's Hospitality Arts program. That's Talk of Iowa for today. Talk of Iowa, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dennis Reese.